Thank you for joining us, and welcome to another edition of Answers Network. I'm your host, Alan Cardoza, and for those of you that have been listening, sending in questions and comments, thank you so much, and please continue to help spread the word that every Monday from 11 a.m. to noon Pacific time, this show will bring on special guests that can educate, that can entertain, and in many cases inspire, while bringing you answers and options to making our lives happier, healthier, and more successful. And I'd really appreciate it if you could all do me a big favor. Please forward one of our shows to your social media group and to someone you know who can benefit from a particular subject. This is one powerful way we can make a positive influence in the world together. Now, before we get to our guest, I want to share some information on an upcoming event that is so beneficial to those in need. I just feel honored to share it with you. The Inner City Law Center, a nonprofit law firm, which is dedicated to advocating for the rights of low-income and unhoused individuals, will be hosting their annual back-to-school drive at its office parking lot at 1309 East 7th Street in Los Angeles. Now, this event serves as a vital opportunity for Angelenos to contribute and assemble essential school materials for over 300 children experiencing housing insecurity in Los Angeles. Now, there are many ways to help, which include setting up tents and tables, sorting donations, assembling backpacks, and writing uplifting notes to the students. Now, it'll be held on August 3rd from noon to 3 p.m. Now, to volunteer, please contact Aaron Thompson at ethompson@innercitylaw.org. Again, that's ethompson@innercitylaw.org. Now, if you can't make it, another way that you can help is you can go to their website, which is innercitylaw.org, and make a donation, because every bit helps. Now, if you're a longtime listener or a dear friend that has supported this show, you know that I believe strong listening and communication skills are essential for fostering healthy, respectful, and fulfilling relationships in all areas of life. Now, they help create a supportive and collaborative environment where individuals can thrive and build lasting connections. So, who better to teach listening and communication skills than a certified forensic interviewer? Our guest today, Michael Reddington, is also president of Inquasive Inc., and he's the author of The Disciplined Listening Method. Now, with over a decade of experience training investigators globally in non-confrontational interview and interrogation techniques, Michael received the Outstanding Contribution Award from the U.S. Homeland Security. Now, transitioning from educating investigators to executives, Michael realized that effective leaders and interrogators share common skills such as vision and influence. Now, combining business communication research with interrogation techniques, Michael developed the Disciplined Listening Method, offering a unique approach to strategic ethical observation and persuasion in business conversations. Now, having conducted over 1,500 programs worldwide, Michael has already educated over 15,000 participants from over 50 countries. His expertise spans leadership communication, sales, negotiation, conflict resolution, customer service, and influential instruction. Michael has been featured in Forbes, Fast Time, as well as other print and online magazines, and has guest lectured at universities that include Harvard and Northwestern. Be it in business or family life, his book, The Disciplined Listening Method, enhances leaders' strategic observation and communication skills. Michael, welcome to Answers Network.
Thank you very much for having me, Alan. It's great to be here.
Well, it is my pleasure. And one of the first things that came to mind to me when I was doing my research, that, you know, and for those that know, I mean, I'm also an investigator. So as a fellow investigator, I'm intrigued as to how your experience as a certified forensic interviewer inspired the development of your book, The Disciplined Listening Method, and how you decided that this is going to be a perfect thing for leadership communication.
I appreciate you asking. Thank you. So my investigative career started off as a happy accident. It was a part-time job that burned out of control and ended up being a full-time career. Cliff Notes version of that story. And honestly, the same thing happened with my interrogation career. They needed somebody to have a conversation. I got tapped on the shoulder. I was too dumb to say no. So here I go. It was a conversation and now we're off to the races. But for me, the more I got into interview and interrogation, and specifically non-confrontational, rapport-based, help people protect their self-image and feel good about making the decision to tell the truth, that style of interview and interrogation, yeah. The more I became fascinated with why people continuously choose to tell the truth, when, as I'm sure you know, quite frankly, there aren't any good consequences in the immediate aftermath. Like some right. Long-term good changes might happen in their life, but in the short term, things are likely going to get at least a little bit worse for them. So I started really diving into the psychology behind this process, why people choose to tell the truth, you know, bonding, attachment theory, this whole thing. And that's what led me to gain my certified forensic interviewer designation, because at least at the time, that was the highest available designation of expertise in the private mm-hmm. sector. And then from there, still being fascinated is what led me into, as you said, the business communication research and best practice. But honestly, for me, to answer your question about the transition from the interrogation to beyond business and personal life, first, I started noticing how the exact same observation and communication techniques were paying dividends in literally every high value conversation in my personal life. Mm-hmm. And then on the training side, when I would go work with investigators or conduct an investigation, often the CEOs or senior leadership would pull me aside after and be like, hey, you think you can help me with this negotiation, this customer? Yeah. And we would put mm-hmm. together the strategy, and lo and behold, it would work. And so that's when it really dawned on me that a lot of times, and I'm probably going to get this term wrong, but I just learned this last week working with another psychologist. I'm not a psychologist, another psychologist that I've worked with. I think they call it functional fixedness. When people assume that, like, I learned something in one area, so that's the only area that this skill applies to. Okay. I was very fortunate to see that these, when you combine these skills that have been kind of siloed for so long, the relationship outcomes, the initiative outcomes, the information people will share, it just grows so much that my fascination continued and it developed into the book. And now here we are today. So I'll try not to take all 50 minutes answering your first question, but that's the background.
No, actually that's wonderful. In fact, I've had many a listener or viewer that has sent in messages to us and said, you know, I just want to tell you that I appreciate the fact that, that you don't just get soundbite answers. They said, I'm so tired of that. They go, I feel like I come away learning something. So I absolutely like and respect, you know, the answers when it goes into greater depth. And in fact, one way I think that people can understand a little bit more, because again, we've been investigators. So a lot of the things, and when you're saying it, I'm clicking, right? I'm like, yeah, I get it. But for those people that maybe aren't, you know, share some examples, you know, maybe from the book, you know, where the method led to a significant breakthrough in, you know, in a conversation, in a deal, in a leadership, you know, responsibility. Share something. And I know there's some great ones in the book if you want to just pick one of your favorites.
Sure. And I can use a couple of different examples, business and personal. Again, I don't want to take up the whole show just with the examples. But one, I'll do a, here's one that's not in the book, but will be in the next one, where I was asked to negotiate essentially a real estate deal on behalf of a client that deemed themselves too emotional to do it themselves. And they gave mm-hmm. me $500,000 bottom line. If you can get this, we'll sell. If not, you know, we're not going to do it. Okay, no problem. So here we go. So long story short, I end up on the phone with somebody who I believe is likely the primary buying opportunity, who has way more experience in this world than I do. So mm-hmm. I use one of my favorite techniques, which is giving the other person control of the conversation. Right. Generally, when someone else feels like they're in control, their guard is down, they share more information. So he ended up giving me all kinds of information on other deals in the area and what he paid and why and what he's seen this property and what he thinks it's valued at and why. And I'm taking notes the whole time. And about halfway mm-hmm. through, I'm like, he ain't going to give us 500 grand. And honestly, it might not be worth 500 grand. So mm-hmm. when we get to the end, he tells me that, you know, max he could do might be 415 and all the reasons why. I just thanked him for it. I said, I've got other people on my list I need to call. I appreciate it. I'll be transparent. So a couple of people later, I call. Thankfully for me, they were very eager buyers. And when I told them what the property was, they immediately came in and offered me $500, like right out of the gate. So using that investigator's mindset, instead of just accepting it and closing it, I got into the conversation with them. Thank you so much. Now, here's that inquisitive approach, right?
Right.
I'm just curious, you know, why are you so excited about it? You were really quick to throw out that number. Now they feel like they need to justify that number. But now what they're doing is they're educating me. Mm-hmm. So now I go back to the first guy to say, hey, in transparency, this is who I talked to. This is what they offered. I promised you I'd be transparent. I'm not playing one against the other. So he lectures me about how it's not worth it, but he'll match it. And honestly, he's the better buyer. He's got the banks lined up. He doesn't need financing. He can pay straight away. So I'd rather buy with him. So I call the second group back just to tell them I appreciate everything, but I'm going to go with another buyer. They asked me, what would we have to pay you for you to choose us? I said, honestly, I feel comfortable with the other buyer. You didn't do anything wrong. They said, we'll do $525. Now I've got a moral problem because $25,000 is a really big difference.
Yeah.
So I say, I appreciate that. Let me call you back. Let me talk to my client. So I call the original guy back and I say, listen, I'm not messing with you and I'm not going to keep going back and forth. They offered me $525. That's a big enough gap where I have a responsibility to my client. So he kind of gets upset about it's not worth that. And here's another technique I use a lot. I agreed with him. I said, you know what? It's probably not worth that. But my job is to get my client this money. And they straight up offered it to me. So he asks me, how close do I have to get? And I said, great question. You don't have to match it. You're the easier guy to buy through. I trust you more. So how close can you get? He said, would you do 507? I said, I need you to get to 515. Just 100% transparent. If you get to 515, this is done. I go back and they tell me $600,000. I don't care. This is over at 515. I said, I respect everything you've worked with me. He said, well, why don't you take a couple of days and think about it? So I set a note on my calendar and I called him back 2 days later. And I said, hey, I'm still at 515. And here comes the last technique. He said to me, you're going to let $8,000 come between us. Now, please don't check my math on how I repeat this because it's probably going to be a little bit different than how I said it. I said to him, as a matter of fact, no, it's $30,000. And he said, excuse me. And I said, this is a retirement investment decision by my client. So although it's $8,000 now, if you figure an annual average return of 6% for the next 25 years, it's a $30,000 decision. Yes. I'm going to let $30,000 come between us. If you can get to 515, if it's done, I'm going to go with the other people. You've been awesome. I'm just being honest. Mm-hmm. He sighed and he said, no one's ever done that to me before. I said, done what? He said, use that technique. I'm like, brother, that wasn't a technique. That was math. Like, I'm just being honest with you. It's like, I'll give you the 515. And it was done. I called the other people back and I kept my word. So, you know, talk about using techniques there, honesty, transparency, inquisitive mindset, creating new and unique outcomes that other people haven't anticipated, allowing everyone to save face and feel in control of the conversation. So all of those things, even though there was a back and forth with multiple parties, everybody felt like they were being treated with respect, that they were on the level, there was no distrust, and allowed us to, honestly, I got an extra $100,000 out of a guy. Now, to be honest, I got a little help on the outside from that second offer. But the approach really would let that happen.
No, I love that. And it actually, and I just kind of want to share with everybody that in these situations, you're referring to things as techniques, but it isn't as if you are, that you have a checklist and that it's okay, I'm going to use technique A or whatever. It's just something that comes natural. And what it reminded me of was, I've also produced some movies, and I was in a situation. This is the second movie that I was involved with, and the director made me the UPM or the unit production manager. Okay, we're in a roundtable meeting, and I'm typing into my computer as if I'm taking notes, going, "What is a unit production manager?" So I had no idea, and it put me in charge of the other managers, and. So the first time one of them, so their job was if they needed something, whatever their department was, they had to come to me first rather than bother the director. Well, the first one that came to me said, okay, well, here's the situation. And, you know, and say, you know, I want this and I want to do this and stuff. And I said, now you understand that I'm an investigator. So think of it as if I'm just working undercover in this position. if you were in my position, what would you do? Because you really understand your department so much better than me. And they explained everything out so well. And as you said, I kept learning. Every time they came to me, I learned something, but because I didn't pretend to them that I knew what I was doing, that it, all of a sudden, they were even telling me times in which why I shouldn't approve what they're asking for. Because they go, well, normally it would be, I need this and stuff. But you know, the reality of it is when I'm in your position, I would kind of think maybe I'd do this. Okay, great. Let's do that. So anyway, my point is that I love the fact that you moved from what we're calling technique after technique. But the reality of it is, it's all one motion of things as they come up, knowing where to shift your focus. And anyway, and I love it. So I think it's a great story.
I appreciate it. Thank you.
Yeah. So, and as I said, we've had some calls that have come in, and I have one here that came in. So this one is from Bill in San Francisco, California. And it says, as a senior manager of a corporation that does about $50 million in revenue, I've been increasingly frustrated with the candidates that I interview to hire for entry-level positions. What do you suggest someone in my position, can do to hire better and be able to keep good employees?
Okay, couple layers there. Bill, I appreciate you sending it in. Good luck to your 49ers this year. When you look at that, there's layers to that question. And yes. Bill, obviously we haven't met, so I would say this to absolutely anybody. Anytime I'm working with somebody who feels frustrated, the first question I'm going to ask them is to unpack the frustration. Is the frustration because people aren't meeting your expectations? If so, does that mean our expectations need updating or recalibrating? Are we frustrated because we feel like there just aren't good candidates out there in general? You know, what's the reason that we're frustrated? But even moving beyond that, mm-hmm. when it comes to bringing on great candidates, there's really two opportunities at the biggest level. One is sourcing, and the second is identifying. So when it comes to sourcing, without any details, I would just say, be aware of how you're sourcing your potential employees, where you're sourcing them from, and are there other ways to look at that? Several of the traps, I guess, that we really work with employers to avoid, number one, is get away from the years of experience trap, if that is one that you're falling into. Anytime we say, I need somebody with 10 years of experience, that's not what we're saying. What we're saying is we believe we need somebody who has the skills and perspective that mm-hmm. it takes 10 years to develop. So if we start saying we need somebody with 10 years of experience, let's walk back from that and say, well, wait a minute, what are the skills and perspective we need them to have? Okay, let's go identify that. Maybe they've got 10 years of experience, maybe they don't. Another trap is same industry. A lot of times we hear people say, well, I don't have a good candidate from this industry. Well, maybe you don't need a good candidate from this industry. What do you really need them to do? What are the outcomes you really need them to create? And sure, if they come from this industry, that might be a shortcut. It might be a problem if they're bouncing right. around within the same industry. So clearly, and I got this from the book, Who, what I'm about to share. Okay. An easy title to remember. Best book on candidate interviewing I've ever read. But when we're looking to fill a position, start with the outcomes that we're looking for them to achieve. Not the tasks we're looking for them to do, but the outcomes. Mm-hmm. So as an entry-level person, what are the outcomes that we need from them? When their job is done, what happens next? Is it a culture impact? Is it a communication impact? Is it a client experience impact? Is it a quality of production impact? Whatever it is, what are the outcomes? Then when you look at the outcomes, now it's what skills do they need to generate those outcomes? Then mm-hmm. it's what attributes. Work ethic is an attribute. Perseverance is an attribute. Coachability is an attribute. What attributes do they need? Cool. And then literally build your ideal candidate profile. And the profile of skills and attributes has nothing to do with age, years of experience, gender, none of that stuff. It's just, these are the skills and attributes I believe I need. And then go interview to match that profile. Another big mistake we often make is we look at two variables at the end of the experiment. I want to hire somebody. I don't have a control. I don't know what great really looks like. So I've got these two variables and I'm comparing one variable against the other to see which I like better. And sometimes that works, but a lot of times it doesn't. So when you create that that standard, now you can compare the variables to it. One last thought is when you're asking questions, a couple of quick things about the, let me do this. Two thoughts. I apologize, Alan. Mm-hmm. Number one, add as many experiential elements to the candidate selection process as possible. Don't ask them if they can use Microsoft Excel. Pull up a program, spin the computer around, and ask them to do something. Ask them to write a formula, troubleshoot the code, enter something, make them do it. If somebody is writing UX code, have them do it. If somebody needs to know QuickBooks, put up a dummy account if you can, have them do it. If somebody needs to do something manual and for insurance purposes, you can't really have them do it. Okay, walk them out to someplace in your yard. If it's a mechanic, open the hood to a truck, stand over the hood with them and have them walk you through how they would troubleshoot a problem. Give them as many experiential elements as they can to demonstrate their thought process, their problem-solving process. Because even if they're not perfect, if they've got a great problem-solving process, we can coach them. Then when it comes to the interview itself, please stop asking compound questions. Alan, you've heard this one. Please tell me about a time where you experienced conflict with the supervisor, what that conflict was about, how it started, how it made you feel, how you chose to address it, what the outcome was, and what you would do different. Thank you for asking me 8 questions that I'll never remember to answer, and you're too impatient to let me answer. So instead, the question is, please walk me through. Alan, please walk me through the most significant conflict you ever had to navigate with a superior. Then you just let them finish and you answer the question. You ask your follow-up questions after. Mm-hmm. Also, please stop asking, tell me about a time, because that falls into how people prepare and it gives them poetic license. Ask for specific opportunities. When was the first time? What was the last time? What was the most difficult time? What was the most rewarding time? Ask questions like that to get more specific answers. So try to get 3 hours worth of answering that question into about 5 minutes. I hope that helped you, Bill. I appreciate you asking. Alan, I'm happy to adjust or go back, whatever you'd like.
Well, and actually, as you were saying that, what I thought would be great is now let's take the other side of that question. You're now the person that's going in. You're the person that just graduated with an accounting degree, and you're going to one of the big 8 accounting firms, and you're interviewing along with 17 other people interviewing for that position. What do you tell that person that moves them to the top of the list?
First things first, be yourself. All other 17 people in that waiting room have the exact same credentials that you do. So to go in and say, I graduated at the top of my class, I went to this university, I was in this club, I had this leadership position, so didn't everybody else. So by the time we get to that room, everybody in there is special, important, smart, whatever. So be you. If you're introverted, be introverted. If you're extroverted, be extroverted. But most importantly, just be yourself, because that is going to carry a lot of weight, especially in some of those more entry-level positions where people are not expecting miracles. They're looking for somebody who they can develop in the organization, take under their wing, use as a mentor. Everybody talks about preparation, but prepare from a problem-solving perspective. I truly believe that success in almost any interaction, and Alan, this comes from investigations, comes down to variable management. The more variables I have under control before the conversation starts, the more calm I can be, the less I have to think, the less I have to talk to myself, and the more I can focus on exactly what's happening in front of me in real time. So if there's questions I'm confident I might be asked or areas I want to be more sure of, practice in those areas. Mm-hmm. You know, one of the things I would also say is when you're in the interview, take time to answer the question. They're not holding a stopwatch. Oh, he took 1.75 seconds. The other kid took 1.64 seconds. He's hired. No. Honestly, it helps you get into a rhythm. You get a question, repeat it to yourself, take a deep breath, answer it. And the more you fall into that rhythm, the easier it is to access the information in your brain. We've all been there. Heck, I go to a networking event and somebody asked me the name of a dude I've been working with for years, and all of a sudden it evaporates because I just wasn't expected to be asked that question at that point in time. So the more you can get yourself into that rhythm, the more comfortable it will be. So those would be a few tips right out of the gate.
I think that's great. We're going to take a break, but for everybody out there, stay with us. We're speaking with certified forensic interviewer Michael Reddington. And when we come back, we're going to talk a little bit more about his book. And he has some very interesting ideas. In fact, what I'd love to to talk about, Mike, when we come back is, you know, the seven core behaviors. So for everybody, stay with us. You're listening to or watching Answers Network.
Conflict International are experts at uncovering the truth. Our specialist team has decades of experience in providing a range of bespoke investigation and intelligence services to companies and individuals. Whether you need professional screening or background checks of employees, due diligence of potential clients or business partners, asset tracing services, or surveillance, Conflict International has a rapid response team on hand to get you to the heart of the matter. Our key strength is in our global capabilities. We can tap into an extensive network of trusted professional investigators based in most jurisdictions worldwide, enabling us to go almost anywhere a case takes us. Conflict International has decades of experience with a diverse range of skills among our team, developed from backgrounds in military and security intelligence services, as well as practiced lawyers. Visit our website today at conflictinternational.com to find out more about our services. That's conflictinternational.com. Global reach, local knowledge.
And we're back. I'm Alan Cardoza. We're speaking with Mike Reddington. We're talking about his new book, The Disciplined Listening Method. So, Mike, when we went to break, I noticed that, and when I was going through the book, can you share a little bit about the seven core behaviors that empower leaders to build valuable relationships and being able to continually drive positive results?
Certainly. I appreciate you asking. So there's a quick back step and then we'll get into it. When we set out to create the disciplined listening method, and before, Alan, you mentioned like having a checklist, you know, do this, then that. When you're in an interview or an interrogation, a lot of times it's kind of easy to go 1 through 10 because you're in that controlled environment. But when you break out of that environment, the business and family conversations we all have, it's really hard to go steps 1 through 10. So when we set out to create the disciplined listening method, based on all of our experience and what we had learned, we weren't trying to step it. Really, what the question that we set out to answer was, when people consistently go into conversations with the odds stacked against them, and most people tapping them on the shoulder and going, good luck, dude, yet they continuously come out successful, what are they doing? And so our research to answer that question led us to the following seven steps. And honestly, to your point, they're reflected in the negotiation example we gave, and even in Bill's answer to approaching the candidate interviews. So the first two behaviors are really pre-conversation behaviors. The first one is understand how any interaction can get you closer to achieving your long and short-term goals. Almost, I hate to say always or never, right? But a significant majority of the time when we find ourselves saying or doing something that 5 seconds later we wish that we didn't, or we realize there was a better way, it's because we got hijacked by the moment. Whatever, addressing what we were feeling in that moment became more important than achieving the outcome that we needed to earn. So not just the short term, but the long term. So for my wife and my son and I, my long term outcome is to have a healthy, loving, supporting family. And our son grows up to be a well-adjusted, happy, contributing member of society, right? So no matter what we deal with in the interim, it all has to be framed around that. If I'm in an investigation, yes, my goal is to get the truth, but really my goal is to get the truth that allows my client to stay safe and to make the right decisions and for a case to proceed seamlessly. Or honestly, if the person in front of me didn't do it, so that we get that and we redirect the investigation where it needs to go. In business, do I really need to solve this he said, she said personality crisis right now by telling them both stop it and act like adults? Or do I need to realize that this is having a long-term impact on customer relationships and employee morale, therefore profit and my stress level? So if I work it from the big goals back, I'll be more successful. So that's step one. Connect every interaction to those long-term goals, not just the short-term. The second is to build our communication strategies based on our perceived weaknesses, not our perceived strengths. And you did a great job illustrating that when you became the project manager. I forgot the title that you said already. Yeah. But you looked it up and then said, oh, wait, that should probably be them. So let me frame it. So they're the ones that are teaching me. All too often, our perceived strengths create blinders and biases. So for me personally, instead of going into any conversation and preparing by asking myself, so why should Alan do what I want him to? Well, in reality, the answer is he probably shouldn't. So that's the question I ask first. Why shouldn't Alan do what I want him to? And I'll write those answers down. And then once I feel like I've explored that fully, I'll look at that list and I'll ask myself, what does Alan need to experience in order to overcome these and say or do what I need him to say or do? So now communication becomes this experience curation, where it's not just the words I need to use, but it's the whole experience. When, where, who, order of topics, all these things become very important. So if I've connected this interaction to a longer-term goal and I'm capitalizing on my perceived weaknesses, now when I start the conversation, I want to be patient and let the conversation come to me. Because as you illustrated, listening equals learning. And the more I learn, the more data I collect, the more advantages I have, the more new roads I can create to get to the same destination, the more control they feel, the more they open up and share and all those things. Now, the next one might sound a little bit surprising coming from somebody with an investigations background, but while I'm evaluating that, I want to evaluate the totality of the communication I'm seeing, changes in their comfort levels, not truth or deception. Truth or deception is going to lend, our biases are going to come into play. We're probably going to be wrong more than we're right, whether we'd like to admit that or not. Our emotions are going to get involved. So to be honest, I would prefer people don't lie to me. But if they are lying to me, they're engaged. We're having a conversation. We can work with that. So why get mad about it? In fact, in a lot of situations, people lie because they believe it's their last good decision. Like, it's nothing personal. They're just trying to avoid the consequences. So instead, what I want to do, and four gets into five, is I'm evaluating changes in their comfort levels, I want to begin to adapt my approach accordingly. So if I see them really uncomfortable in an area, I've got decisions to make. Do I back away? Do I press? Do I come at it from another angle later? If all of a sudden they're getting really comfortable, why? Was this something they were prepared for? Did they have a strategy? Or am I just approaching them the right way and I should continue because now they're really comfortable? The next step, it comes down to always helping them save face. And I know always and never are tough to say. It's really hard to find a time where helping somebody save face and protect their self-image is a bad decision. The more we can help people save face, this is a natural human need that gets overlooked way too much. I'll be working with CEOs, senior leaders, salespeople, negotiators. Well, how come he didn't do it? Well, because you made him look like a fool in front of his whole team. So we had two choices. Accept a pretty good deal, but look like a moron for doing it, or kick you out of the room and protect his ego. I can't blame him for kicking you out of the room. So helping people save face is enormous. That's a through thread that goes through the entire process. And then the last one is build trust equity with post-conversation follow-up. Oftentimes we believe that this traditional approach to active listening we've been taught, which is good. This is, I'm not running it down, is enough to convince people that we listen to them. And it's not. And think about it. How many times have you had a conversation with somebody, felt like they absolutely listened, they were in tune to you, and then after the conversation, their behavior didn't change, they did nothing that you talked about. Now we feel like we're ignored. But if we realize that the start of one interaction is the beginning of the next, and that time in between is the glue that keeps these together, now we can leverage that time to follow up, maybe bring up something that was important to them, but really didn't mean a whole lot to us, something maybe personal about them. But we can build that post-trust or post-communication trust, excuse me, while we talk in between conversations. So it's not just, Alan, here's what I need from you today. Alan, here's what I need from you today. So those and synopsis would be the seven core behaviors of the disciplined listening method that we really look to apply as consistently as possible in our high stakes conversations in relationships. And high stakes doesn't necessarily mean dollar signs or does it make the news? You know, high stakes is for us, for our life, our relationships.
Oh, I love that. And so funny, as you were saying that, it was taking me in so many different directions. One was in regards to always and never. The thought that popped into my mind was, oh, yeah, he got that from testifying, because the attorneys drill it into our head when we're going to testify. You never use always or never. And so as I was listening to you, that was very interesting to me. And I love the concept of saving face, and especially for anybody who's traveled internationally. It is so important, and in many cases, it's it's so important that it's the difference between things happening or not happening in other countries. It's much more severe. So anyway, so I think those are great points to be able to touch on. Now, another area that you touch on that I thought was interesting, which was called, you called it ethical observation play. So be it in home or business, in your opinion, what role does strategic ethical observation play in effective leadership communication? And how is it different from some of the more traditional approaches?
It plays an enormous role. And just a funny example, before we came on, my wife and I had a meeting with some of the teachers at my son's school because he's about to start school. So she's kind of your beginning of the year stuff. And probably because of my bias and my crazy brain, my wife and I went out to lunch before the meeting. And when we did, she dripped a little salad dressing on her shirt. And she was all like self-conscious about it. So when we sat down with the teachers, she crosses her legs, she puts her handbag on her lap, and she's holding her handbag in front of herself. Now, I look at that and I think two things. She's still thinking about the salad dressing. Oh, this is exactly what people teach you to look for when people are lying or uncomfortable because they're setting up barriers and protecting themselves.
Exactly.
She had salad dressing on her shirt. Right. So when we talk about strategic and ethical observation and persuasion techniques, we talk about really being open to the totality of circumstances in the context of the situation. That often these behaviors that get tied into deception or lying or all of these negative things could maybe mean that, but right. They could also maybe mean about 100 other things too. So if I'm very in tune to how somebody else is thinking and feeling through their behaviors and reactions, I can be more empathetic. I can do a better job connecting. I can do a better job influencing them. I can honestly build better relationships. But on the ethical side, I've got to question my intentions. Am I doing this for my benefit and their loss? Mm-hmm. Is this a trick where I'm making them feel really positive about something, but there's a guillotine going to drop over here and there's a big penalty for it? You know, that would all fall on the unethical side. And then getting out of those myths and understanding that as their behavior changes in front of me, it's all comfort and discomfort. What does it mean in the context of the situation? And how does it get me closer to achieving our goals in a way that you just hit on that we can all save face and feel better about it at the end of the conversation?
Now, taking the situation that you just mentioned with you and your wife, put yourself on the other side of this table. You're now one of the, you're the principal or whomever it was that was there representing the school. And you're looking across at that and you're seeing her holding the purse close to her. Tell me how you handle that situation so that you keep yourself from being sort of pulled into that paradigm of she must be hiding something.
Great question. So first I just register it. There is something I didn't expect to see. Okay, fine. And then over the course of time, I look for changes in that comfort level. So it's a 45-minute conversation. As the clock goes on, does she, my wife has no idea I'm bringing this up on a live conversation, by the way, so hopefully we're still married by the end of the day. As the conversation goes on, does she start looking more nervous? Okay, if she starts looking more nervous, more uncomfortable, then maybe there is something here that I don't know about. But if she doesn't, if she appears to stay the same or get less comfortable, is the room cold? Is she sitting in a children's chair? Like, there's all of these other things to think about. So to get back to the first question you asked, as a certified forensic interviewer, one of the things that got beaten into my head with a metaphorical sledgehammer was totality of circumstances. Context is king, context is queen. What is everything else that's going on around me? So her voice is calm. Her questions are clear. She's answering. She's receptive. Like, there's no other behavior going on here. Maybe I didn't know that she had the salad dressing on her shirt. Maybe that's just a comfortable way for her to sit. Is she sitting right underneath an air conditioning vent? Like, all of these questions are the questions that we need to start to ask. So I'm not a scientist. I didn't stay at a Holiday Inn Express last night, for anyone who remembers those commercials from 20 years ago. But it almost becomes like the scientific method where I realize something. So now I look for opportunities for it to be wrong. So instead of saying, look how nervous she is, she's hiding behind her bag. It's, ooh, she's sitting behind her bag. I didn't expect to see that. I wonder if that doesn't mean. Like, so now I flip the question. And because I flip the question in my own head, I'm looking for different intelligence that leads to the potential of different outcomes.
I love that. Yeah. And I think too many times people get stuck in like an old paradigm of this means this and this means that. And so now you're actually treating them differently because of that. And it's like, no. So I love the way that you're approaching that. We're going to take a break again. We've got a question that's coming in from a single mom it's going to talk about communicating better with her teenagers. So for everybody out there, stay with us. We'll be right back. You're listening to or watching Answers Network.
Having a teenager at risk who is going through a traumatic experience can be difficult on parents, siblings, and all who are working with that young person. No family should have to go through this process alone. Westshield Adolescent Services is here to ensure you don't have to. Many of the psychologists and psychiatrists we work with have spoken about the stress families go through. Not just the young person, but the parents, needing to get their child to a program where they can get the help they need. Westshield aims to lessen that stress. Every case goes through a thorough intake process with one of our knowledgeable, compassionate intake coordinators. We want to know the likes, the dislikes, and the fears of each child. This important information is taken into consideration when choosing the best suited team member for each individual teenager. Westshield agents come from all different walks of life, giving us a diverse group of team members to ensure a personalized, compassionate experience for every teenager. This allows us to make certain every young person we work with gets to the chosen program in the best possible state of mind. We contacted over 600 of the youth we've worked with in the past to see where they're at now. 97% of these individuals told us how much their lives had improved, that they had better relationships with their friends and families, had gone on to marry, have kids, and were now using the skills they learned in their program to raise their own children. Our role of transporting at-risk teenagers is a vital step in the process of ensuring a youth's ability to thrive in their new environment, and is a role we don't take lightly. The recovery process can be a long one, but like any journey, it started with a single step.
And we're back. We are talking about communication. We're talking about interviewing and ways to communicate that's a win-win situation. And we have a question that's come in. This one reads, I'm a single mom with two teenagers that I'm struggling to have meaningful conversations with. Can you provide examples of strategies or how to initiate meaningful conversations with teenagers who are resistant or withdrawn? And actually, it looks like, I don't know if this is two questions from the same person. This is another one comes through. It says, along those same lines, how can parents balance active listening with setting boundaries and maintaining authority in their relationship with their teenage children? So Samantha in Houston, Texas.
Cool. Well, Samantha, thank you very much for submitting the questions. I'm assuming that they both came from her. If not, thank you to both people. Yeah. Who sent in. Yeah. And Samantha, first, let me acknowledge that I'm not a single parent. I'm certainly not a single mom with two teenage kids. So I don't understand the situation exactly the way it's happening in your home, and I want to be very open and honest about that up front. When it comes to communicating with teenagers, you said a couple of things right out of the gate. Honestly, based on where they are in life in general, they're kind of supposed to be withdrawn. They're not really supposed to want to talk. They're experiencing a lot of things, whether they understand it or not, that maybe they don't know how to talk about, or they don't want to talk about, or they're embarrassed, or they're fearful to talk about. And it's really important to start there. Often the number one fear that will stop anybody from opening up is the fear of embarrassment. Now, there's other consequences that come into play. Am I going to lose the car? Am I going to be able to see my girlfriend? Am I going to get pulled off the football team? You know, whatever, whatever. But am I going to be arrested, depending on the situation? But that fear of embarrassment is really where it starts. So, Alan, when we talked about helping people save face, that's a big one. So every family is different. I'm not here to tell any family what their values should be or how to raise their children. And obviously, every child is different as well. But when we start looking at having conversations with teenagers, again, context is key. So I would recommend start paying attention to when might be the best opportunity to have these conversations. Is it in the car ride on the way home? If you do get to have dinner together, is it over dinner? Is it on Saturday evenings as opposed to Monday mornings? Is it maybe in the morning over breakfast? You know, when do these conversations typically, when are they more fruitful? Also, they don't have to be done in one talk. So again, every kid is different, but there might be the opportunity to ease into where we start via text messages or some other mode of communication and then get into sitting down and face-to-face. A lot of conversations tend to go better, just as a general rule, if we're out taking a walk, if we're having a meal, if we're doing something else besides just sitting face-to-face and talking. Yeah. Anytime we can illustrate things that we've overcome in our own life or issues that we've dealt with, and I certainly know as a parent, you know, there's stories I probably don't want to tell my son until he's at least 35 years old, right? But at the same time, illustrating to him that I have been through, not the same, but situations that were close enough that the emotions I feel are in line with the emotions that they're feeling. Little things, anytime, it's especially true with teenagers, anytime somebody tells me I don't understand, I look them right in the face and I say, you're right. Huh? It's the last thing they're expecting to hear. It shortcuts the argument. And now I can ask them to help me understand. This is why the conversation is so important. One of the things we try to do is separate truth and consequences, that yes, actions have consequences, but the truth doesn't. So we try to separate that. Even outside of the consequential, that doesn't mean there are consequences associated, but the consequential, the heavy conversations, we really look, and this comes from investigations, we really look for opportunities to say yes, because I know there's going to be lots of times where I have to say no, and I have to ask tough questions, and there's going to be consequences. So in other scenarios, I want to find reasons to say yes, so that way they're less fearful when it comes to the main conversation. And I also want to try to keep in mind that, again, these conversations don't exist on islands. So if I know that I could potentially have some big conversations looming, I want to start priming them, if you will, but having conversations in a new way. So to them, they're like, oh, well, this feels different. Where's mom going with this? Why is this different? Where's dad going with this? Why is this different? So that way now when the real big heavy conversation comes, we've had this different approach for a couple of weeks, a couple of months, whatever it is, that helps change the dynamic of the relationship before we get there. One of the other things, and I'll pause here, Alan, for your input, is as often as possible, we want to focus on the context, not the person. The word you can be one of the more dangerous words in the entire human language. It attacks their self-image. It puts people on the defensive. It makes the conversation much more difficult. Respectful of your family, teenagers coming home late. As a teenager, hopefully to a degree that they're still safe, coming home late is part of testing the waters, right? It's kind of what I was guilty of that any number of times. So if my son comes home late and I'm standing there at the door when he comes in, why are you late? You knew you're supposed to be home half an hour ago. You're in trouble. You're not going out next Friday night. He's never going to be honest with me about anything.
Right.
But now if he comes home late and I'm sitting on the couch and my first words are, hey man, you safe? Everything okay? And his response is, yeah, why would you even ask? I just want to make sure, man, you know, the later it gets, the crazier things happen out there. Just wait till it's a full moon, right? Hey, I'm curious. I know we talked about being home at 11:30 and it's 12:15, but often when people are out with their friends and their friends are saying, go here, go there, do this, call her, we still have time, don't worry about it, it's pretty quick that pressure can start mounting and we can start losing track of time and focus. I'm just curious, how early was it the first time you realized that you might be home late tonight?
Great question.
Now when he comes back and I got built-in excuses, right? Well, Johnny said this and Susie said that, and I've been waiting for Brooke to call me for 3 months and she finally did. Like, so now all these excuses are here. So yeah, it was probably about 9:45 that I figured I'm not going to be home by 11:30. And now in my head, I'm like, 9:45? You couldn't have called me? But this isn't about discipline. This is about education. He's already been late this time. So it's the next one that I'm focusing on now. And now I can start the educational conversation. And yes, if you got to pull his keys, pull his keys. You got to take his phone, take his phone. However you raise your family is fine. I would be careful with bait and switch traps. Oh, you made it sound like I could be nice to you. Now you took my phone and my car and I can't go leave the house for 2 weeks. That's the last time I'm telling you anything. So I'm not saying don't punish them, just careful with the bait and switch. But those would be more of the approaches to help them open up. And I'll just say this last one, Samantha, you mentioned being a single mom. Your family history is absolutely none of my business. But it might be worth reflecting on the potential impact that some of those situations have had on your kids, how that impacts how they feel and how they listen. And sometimes other people are best to deliver messages or to have conversations. So there's times with my son where I might ask a coach to have a conversation, or I might ask his grandfather to have a conversation, or a friend's mother to have a conversation with him, because I know he could get it from me and Brooke, and he probably already has, but it didn't work. So maybe somebody else can get the message through. So life is a series of solvable problems. We can focus on the solution or focus on the problem. And often when we start looking for different solutions, we might find more successful angles. So hopefully that was helpful and not judgmental. I really appreciate you asking, Samantha. Thank you.
And first of all, Michael, I think that's great. And if you decide you want to start speaking at high schools or parent meetings, I think you got another career there. So I want to finish. I just looked up. We've got about 30 seconds. But, you know, as someone who has impacted thousands through your educational engagements worldwide, what key message do you hope readers or our viewers or listeners take away from the book, The Discipline Listening Method?
Stay focused on outcomes. Help people save face. Create the communication experience other people need and be ready to be surprised with the results you achieve.
Michael, thank you so much for coming on. I appreciate it. You mentioned there might be another book coming out. How soon?
It's supposed to already be out. Look at end of 2025 should be the next one.
Okay. But and this current book, anywhere books are sold?
Correct. The Discipline Listening Method, How a Certified Forensic Interviewer Uncovers Hidden Value in Every Conversation, Barnes & Noble, Amazon, DisciplineListening.com.
Perfect. And if they want to get a hold of you, they can go to the website. Is that correct?
Correct. MichaelReddington.com, Inquasive.com, and they can find me on LinkedIn, Michael Reddington, CFI.
Wonderful. Again, thank you so much.
Thank you.
All right. And for everybody out there, if you enjoyed this episode, make sure you click the like button. If you're interested in seeing more content like this, make sure to check out our other shows. You can go to our channel. You can go to our website, which is answers.network, or any major social platform. Remember, for everybody out there, be good human beings and be with us again next week on Answers Network.
You're listening to Answers Network with Alan Cardoza, only on LA Talk Radio.